Last week, if you were here, you heard me preach on the permanence of marriage, that it has been God's plan from the very beginning, that is going all the way back to Adam and Eve, that once a man and woman marry one another, they are to stay in that marriage as long as they both live. I would like to go onward from that point today. I believe I mentioned last week, though probably I didn't emphasize it adequately, that I was giving the general, you might say simple, rule of God about the permanence of marriage. That is not to say that there are not situations in that could arise which make exceptions to those rules. I didn't want at that time to go into the nuances and the exceptions and the details and so forth. It was my point at that time just to lay out generally what God says about the permanence of marriage and emphasize that when we are not able to get along with one another as husbands and wives, or we think we're not able to get along with one another, we have personal difficulties in our marriages, that God does not give us the option of dealing with those personal clashes or conflicts within marriage by divorcing. That is not an option. That is not an optional way of dealing with those difficulties. I would like to go from there this morning and look now at some exceptions, other exceptions that God makes to what I was saying, you know, from the Scriptures about the permanence of marriage. Specifically, I would like us to look at 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. And that's a relatively long chapter. I think it has 40 verses in it. And I hope none of you will mind this, but rather than keep you here 2 or 3 hours and in an effort to say everything I think needs to be said about this chapter, I'm going to break up this lesson into at least 2 sermons and probably 3 sermons. So I hope you won't mind hearing me preach on 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, not only today, but also probably for the next 2 Sundays. I'd like to start off by observing that some of God's commands are situation-specific. Now, what do I mean by situation-specific? I mean to say that they may only apply to certain particular situations, or they are subject to modification or change under certain special circumstances. Or in other words, exceptions may be made to them when certain situations or circumstances arise to cause an exception to be made. This is true with respect to marriage, but not only with respect to marriage, but others of God's commands. Now, let me give you an example, or some examples from the New Testament. The example of circumcision was one that Jesus himself used. Let's turn to John 7, verse 23. We won't take the time now, since I'm just using this as an example, to look at the Old Testament backgrounds to these commands, but if you've been a Bible student for very long, you're probably well aware that the Old Testament required that a male child be circumcised on the 8th day of his life. You're probably also aware that one of the commandments of God was to honor the Sabbath day. And the way in which the Jews honored the Sabbath day was not to do any work on the Sabbath day. However, there was sometimes a clash between these two commandments because, as Jesus implied in John 7, verse 23, sometimes the 8th day of a little boy's life, when he was to be circumcised, would fall on a Sabbath. But you see, circumcision would be regarded as a work. And you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day if you're a Jew. But what if you need to have your child circumcised on the 8th day of his life according to the law, and that 8th day falls on the Sabbath day? What do you do? There's a conflict there. You might say, something's got to give. Okay? Either you're going to go ahead and circumcise that child, despite the fact that circumcision is working, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day, or you're going to have to do it on the seventh day, or maybe on the ninth day, or some other day besides the eighth day. What did the Jews do about that? Well, they went ahead and circumcised their little boys on the eighth days of their lives, even if those eighth days fell on Sabbath days. That's the way they resolved the conflict. And Jesus observes that in John 7, verse 23, when he says, "If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath?" You see, they were saying that, oh, miraculous healing, even miraculous healing is working, and you healed a man on the Sabbath day, therefore you worked on the Sabbath day, and you broke the law. And Jesus is simply pointing out, listen, there are exceptions to God's Sabbath law. Even you recognize that. Because if a little boy's life falls on the eighth day of his life falls on the Sabbath, you circumcise him anyway. So even you make exceptions. And that was the point, really. The Sabbath law regarding work, or no work, was not one that did not admit any exceptions. Some kinds of work, particularly emergency work, could be done on the Sabbath day. And that included circumcising a little boy on the eighth day of his life, even though that's not what we would think of as emergency work. There are other exceptions that we can allude to, and I will just allude to them. For instance, Romans 13, verse 1 says we're to be in subjection to the government. We're to obey the laws legislated by our government then. Are there exceptions to that? Sure. Acts 5, verse 29 indicates that when God's law conflicts with government law, that God's law takes precedence. And we have to obey God's law, even though it means disobeying government law. There's an exception, then, to the rule that we need to subject ourselves to the government. And we could go on and on, but I think that makes the point. You see it, don't you? That sometimes God's laws are situation-specific. That is, they apply to certain situations. Take them outside those situations to which they apply, and they don't apply in other situations anymore. There are exceptions. However, I want to emphasize that this is not to say that all of God's commandments admit exceptions, and that human beings can determine when to make these exceptions. You see, some people can take what I've said and abuse it. For instance, God's moral commandments do not admit exceptions. God says, do not lie. I don't know of any exceptions to that, but God's law makes. We cannot make exceptions to God's law prohibiting lying. God's law says, flee fornication, sexual immorality. I don't know of any exceptions that God's law makes to that. Even though there are some who advocate the moral philosophy called situation ethics, in which the ethics of people, the morality of people, fluctuates, changes from situation to situation. That's not true. Secondly, commandments which are based not upon local conditions or situations, but upon universal principles do not admit exceptions. For instance, Paul in 1 Timothy, the second chapter, says that women are not to teach or exercise authority over man, but to remain quiet, to be in submission. Some people have argued against that by saying, well, in Ephesus, you know, there was a situation there that Paul was dealing with. I mean, apparently the women were really out of control there. So Paul wasn't giving a universal rule. He was really giving a rule that applied just for situations like that there at Ephesus. Well, there are all sorts of problems with that reasoning. For one thing, Paul doesn't say anything like that. There was a problem there at Ephesus. There's no indication of that. It's a complete assumption for them to say something like that. But also, Paul goes on to base what he is saying about womanly subjection upon universal principles that go all the way back to Adam and Eve. He says, pointing out the priority of man and its implications, that it was Adam who was first created and then Eve. And he also goes on to point out that it was Eve who was deceived and not the man. So he's basing what he has to say upon universal principles. That does not admit exceptions like some people want to make. Therefore, it's important to pay attention to the context or any special circumstances which might have a bearing on the scope of the application of a command. How broadly is this command meant to be implied? Is there something in the context of where the command is given that would indicate it applies to a certain situation? We have to pay attention to that. And this is especially true, we're coming now around to 1 Corinthians 7 finally, this is especially true with regard to Paul's remarks on marriage, those remarks which he addressed to the church at Corinth. What Paul says regarding marriage in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and yes, he largely does deal with marriage in that chapter, although he does bring in other situations, particularly circumcision and slavery. What he says there regarding marriage, I don't think can be properly understood unless we understand the context of what he is saying. What he says there in 1 Corinthians 7 cannot be understood or properly applied without a due regard on our part for the fact that what he's saying in 1 Corinthians 7 is a largely situation-specific set of instructions. And what I would like to do in the rest of this lesson is emphasize that point by looking at the evidence throughout the 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians for the fact that there is a specific situation there at Corinth that Paul is dealing with. And then we'll look more specifically at the first 9 verses of this chapter. And that will wind up our lesson for today. So now, let's look at evidences throughout 1 Corinthians 7 that Paul's remarks there are given in view of a specific situation that had arisen there at Corinth. First of all, in verse 1, we have some evidence. Because in verse 1, we see that what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, is a response to questions they had asked. What we have then in 1 Corinthians 7 is a situation in which that might be compared to us listening to one end of a phone conversation. We've probably all done that. Probably quite a few times. Sometimes I will hear my wife talking to someone on the phone, and I'm interested in their conversation. I can't hear what the other person is saying. But I can tell from her responses, I can infer from her responses what the other person is saying. You have the same situation here in 1 Corinthians 7. We don't know exactly what the Corinthians' questions were, or more specifically, how their questions were phrased. But we can infer the questions they were asking by the answers that Paul gave. Okay? Like if someone were to say, four, you could say, well, maybe that person was asked, what's 2 plus 2? It might be something else. They might have been asked, how many quarters are there in a football game? Okay, but in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verse 1, Paul says there, now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. So the reason I'm emphasizing this is because when people ask questions which are raised by their own circumstances, then the answers they get may often be limited in their application to those people's circumstances, may not apply to other people's circumstances. So this means that those in different circumstances would not necessarily get the same answers. Let's go on to the next evidence that Paul is dealing with a specific situation here in these remarks. We've already read verse 1. Notice that he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. The word touch, we can tell because it's contrasted with fornication. It is paralleled with a man having his own wife and a woman having her own husband. Means to have conjugal sexual relations. Okay, it doesn't mean just going up and tapping a woman on the shoulder. Okay? Do you really think, for one thing, that's what Paul is concerned about here? I mean, look at just literally just going up and touching a woman on the shoulder. No, that's the word touch here is referring to sexual relations within the context of marriage. Now, since God intended for sexual relations to be part of the marital relationship, Paul's claim that it is not good, that it is good not to have them, is really limited to the special circumstances in Corinth. We could go all the way back to Genesis, the second chapter, verse 18. And God there actually says, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. And then down in verse 24 it says, for this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the application Paul makes of one flesh in 1 Corinthians 6 is sexual in nature. They become sexually one in the flesh. So, and God said in that context back in verse 18, it is not good for man to be alone. So he made, and really to be specific to our situation this morning, what I'm talking about, he made a sexual partner, a wife, for Adam. So here's my point. How is it that God could say in Genesis 2 verse 18, it's not good for man to be alone, and particularly not good for man to be without a sexual partner? And then Paul come along in 1 Corinthians 7 verse 1 and say, it's good for man not to touch a woman, that is not to have sexual relations with his wife. Well, the only thing we can say in response to that is that Paul must have been dealing with a specific situation in 1 Corinthians 7, whereas God is giving the general rule in Genesis 2, verses 18 and following. Let's move on to the next point. That Paul allowed marriage or sexual relations within marriage, he said, was only a concession on his part. Now, that was because he was dealing with a certain situation. Because otherwise, God fully authorized marriage and sexual relations within marriage. The next point. Now, what we're looking here is at evidence that Paul's not dealing with all situations here in 1 Corinthians 7. He's dealing with a specific situation. How do we know that? Well, that's why we're looking at this. That Paul wished all people were unmarried like him in verse 7 also indicates that he's not talking about the ordinary state of relations among men and women as ordained by God. Because, again, we've already seen, the ordinary rule is, the ordinary relationship is God ordained, and it goes all the way back to Genesis 2. Okay? God generally wants people to get married. And generally people do get married, don't they? I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but generally people do get married. So Paul is really looking at the exceptions to the rule in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, because otherwise, how can he say, despite what God said in Genesis 2, I wish that all people were as I am. Maybe we ought to read that verse again. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 7. He says, yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. You see, Paul was an unmarried man. He's saying that, I wish that all people were unmarried like me. The next piece of evidence. The situation-specific limitation of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 is also indicated by the fact that he said it was good for widows and the unmarried to remain unmarried. Now, this is more or less following up the same point that I've been making for a while now. But let's read verse 8. It says, but I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I, that is, unmarried. Wait, Paul's saying that it's good for widows to remain unmarried like he was? Well, then why does he say over in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, verse 14. Why does he say, therefore I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach? Sounds like he's contradicting what he was saying over in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 8. There he says, I wish they wouldn't get married. There, here, 1 Timothy 5, verse 14, he's saying, I want the younger widows to get married. Again, the explanation for that is that he's talking about a certain limited situation in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. Move on to the next point. That Paul is not laying down universal rules in 1 Corinthians 7 is expressed by the fact that he explicitly shifts back and forth in his remarks between his what he calls his own opinions on one hand and the commandments of the Lord on the other hand. Let's look at several places where he does this. He expresses the Lord's command on one hand, then he expresses his opinion on the other hand. Okay? 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verse 10. There he says, but to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord. Okay? This goes all the way back to what the Lord said. But then in verse 12, he says, but to the rest, I say, not the Lord. And then in verse 25, he says, now concerning virgins, I give no command of the Lord. But I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. And also in verses 35 and 40, which I won't take the time to read now, he indicates there that he's also giving his opinion. As a matter of fact, he uses the word opinion, at least that's the way it's translated in the New American Standard Bible in verse 40. But in my opinion. And here's one that I really want to emphasize. In verse 26, let's read what Paul says there. He says then there, I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for man to remain as he is. Notice that Paul refers to the present distress here. I don't know what the nature of that present distress was. I doubt that we will ever know what it was. But just for right now, let me say this. Whatever it was, it had a big impact upon the kinds of instructions that Paul was giving to the Corinthians. Let's move on. Verses 27 and 28. Now, Paul here is dealing with people either married or unmarried, specifically unmarried. And remember now, Paul is thinking that in this situation, in view of the present distress, that it's good, as he said in verse 26, that people would remain as they were. If they're unmarried, then don't get married. But was that a hard and fast rule? Or could they use their own judgment about it instead of having to follow Paul's judgment? They could use their own judgment. Well, that's a sin if they follow their own judgment, their own opinion, instead of Paul's. No, it wasn't. He says as much. Let's look at verses 27 and 28. Paul there says, "Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I'm trying to spare you." So what Paul is saying is, in effect, is that, my opinion, in view of what we're faced with here, you better, if you're not married, it's good for you not to get married. However, if you think differently, if you persist in getting married, then you haven't sinned. It's not a sin. Because I'm giving you simply my opinion on this. Notice also, and this moves on to the next point, that he bases his advice not to marry on the fact that they would have trouble in this life. And that shows that he was talking about a specific situation. For it were universally true that marriage caused so much difficulty as to cause Paul to recommend its avoidance. You're going to have trouble if you get married. Better not get married, you're going to have trouble. If that were the general rule, then that would conflict with what God says. Like over in Genesis 2, verse 18. So when he says, if you get married, you're going to have trouble, and I want to spare you that trouble, he's obviously got to be talking about a specific situation. And when that situation is relieved somehow, then they could go back to the ordinary course of events in their lives. And that is, if they wish, get married. And they could even get married despite the present distress. But Paul says, okay, you haven't sinned if you make that decision, but I'm telling you, I think you're going to have trouble, and I'd like to spare you the trouble. Let's move on. Paul's statements were limited, we see, by the fact that he says in verses 29 through 31 that the time was shortened and the form of this world was passing away. I want us to pay particular attention to verses 29 through 31, and I'll read them shortly here. But perhaps I've appreciated more than I did in the past as a result of preparing this lesson how much what Paul calls the present distress affected what he had to say here. I think we really need to appreciate the seriousness of the situation, whatever it was they were facing at Corinth, in order to understand what Paul was saying to them in 1 Corinthians 7. Again, let's begin with verse 29 here and read. "But I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they have none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away." Now think about what he is saying. The form of this world is passing away. What does that mean? Well, we know he can't be talking about the end of the world literally. For one, we know that for one thing, because the world's still here. Paul wrote this almost 2,000 years ago. And secondly, he says the form of this world is passing away. In other words, the Corinthians' world, the outward shell of the world that people have created, their life, their environment, social and otherwise, that they have created, and that's going to change. It's going to be done away with. That doesn't mean the earth itself is going to be destroyed as at the end of time. Now, as I said, we'll probably never know the exact nature of that to which Paul referred when he spoke of the present distress. But he clearly describes that present distress in terms which indicate that it was a very significant upheaval, whatever it was. It would be so significant that it would greatly alter what would have been appropriate behavior and relationships under ordinary circumstances. You see, don't get married because the time is shortened. The form of this world is passing away. But once they've been relieved of those circumstances, then the instructions Paul gives here don't apply. Then the ordinary rules come back into play. Let's move on. Now Paul indicates that what is ordinarily good, and what he's talking about in these verses, verses 32 through 35, is pleasing one's mate. Wouldn't you say that's ordinarily a good thing to do, to please your mate? Yeah, I would think so. Men especially, I think, every once in a while get reminded of that when they fail to realize it's important to please their mates. But here he says it's not a good thing, or at least he treats it as if pleasing your mate is a matter of concern to him. Now, all along we could go back to the scriptures and see that God has intended men and women who are married ordinarily to please their mates. Just to give you an example, in Deuteronomy 24, verse 5, a man who was married was basically someone who could not be conscripted into the army, could not go off to fight with the army for a whole year. Why? Because it says there that he may give happiness to his wife. He was to stay at home, and it explicitly says, give happiness to his wife. The Jews were not allowed to say, hey, you newly married man, get thee into the army and be stationed overseas somewhere. Be without your new wife for a year. That may happen in the United States today, but according to Jewish law, that couldn't happen. Why? Because newlyweds were to give happiness to one another, especially within the first year of their lives. And not only that, but I mean, we could look at 1 Corinthians the 5th chapter, and we see that it's implied there, in the latter part of 1 Corinthians the 5th chapter, that a man was to nourish and cherish his wife. A man is to make his wife feel cherished, just like Jesus cherished the church. Don't you feel cherished as a Christian? Jesus died for you on the cross. You ought to feel cherished. You are. Likewise, husbands are to nourish and cherish their wives. Sounds to me like Paul saying husbands ought to please their wives. I don't know how you would make your wife feel cherished without pleasing her in some way. But then we come to 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and Paul talks like that's a matter of concern to him. Let's look at verses 32 through 35. He says, but I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is seemly and secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. Now, he says, I'm not trying to put a restraint on you. Okay, if you want to get married, even in these circumstances, okay, I'm not trying to restrain you from doing that. But whether you're married or not, I want to remind you that you're to be devoted to the Lord. He's to come first, even should you get married in these circumstances. So all of this indicates again that Paul is talking about a particular situation that had arisen in Corinth. A couple more points along these lines. Paul indicates that he's not dealing with universal rules governing sin when he explicitly says that neither giving in marriage nor refusing to give in marriage is a sin. Now, it sounds strange to us in our culture, our modern American culture, that a father would have the right to refuse to allow his virgin daughter to be married. But, folks, what I'm hearing, what I've learned, is that our modern American culture is kind of an exception to that. In the past and in other cultures, even some cultures to this very day, parents have the right to refuse to allow their children to be married. So a man here in Corinth has a virgin daughter. Does he give permission for her to be married or not? What does Paul have to say about that? Well, let's look in verses 36 through 38. But if any man thinks that he is acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she should be of full age, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let her marry. Now, ordinarily, Paul would say, no one, in view of the present distress, fathers, don't allow your daughters to get married. But he understands, like everybody else, sometimes daughters can put a lot of pressures on fathers to get married. I love this man. I want to get married. And she puts pressure on him. And he doesn't want to tell her no. Whether because of her pressure or for some other reason, he doesn't want to have to tell her no. But that's not what Paul wants. Paul wants her to remain unmarried. That's what Paul thinks is best under the circumstances. Does he sin, this man, if he allows his daughter, despite what Paul has said, to get married anyway? Paul says no. No, he has not. He can choose to make that decision. Let's go on ahead and read verses 37 and 38. But he who stands firm in his heart, being under no constraint, but has authority over his own will, and has decided to keep his own virgin daughter, he will do well. Now, especially notice verse 38. So then, both he who gives his own virgin daughter in marriage does well, and he who does not give her in marriage will do better. You do well, you do the right thing in both cases. Whether you give your virgin daughter in marriage or you refuse to give your virgin daughter in marriage, you do well, fathers, either way. I'm just saying, I think the father who refuses to give his virgin daughter in marriage does better. Again, that flies in the face of the general rule. We could go back to Genesis 2, but I don't think by this time I need to, do I? You know, the general rule that God has set up is that it's good for a man and a woman eventually to get married. Find a mate, get married. But there are exceptions to that. There are exceptions to that. Sometimes situations can arise, temporary situations, that make it, shall we say, not a good idea to follow the general rule. If you decide not to follow what Paul says, if you decide to give your virgin daughter in marriage, okay, you do well, but just not as good as the fellow who refuses to give his virgin daughter in marriage. One more point along these lines, that Paul is not dealing with what is sinful, but what is better, or what would make a person happier, is indicated by the fact in verse 40 that he gives his opinion that the widow who remains unmarried will be happier. Let's read verses 39 and 40 now. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is. That is, she's unmarried, she's a widow, she's unmarried. In my opinion, Paul says, she'll be happier. She'll be better off if she remains unmarried. And I think that I have the Spirit of God. Again, I allude to 1 Timothy 4, verse 14, where Paul says he wants younger widows to get married. So this rule that widows will be happier, he thinks, if they remain unmarried, that's for a special set of circumstances. The general rule is, at least in the case of young widows, is that they get married. They'll be happier that way, perhaps. Okay, just want to look at the first 9 verses this morning. We have some more time, so I want to look at the first 9 verses more explicitly. And let's try to deal with them, because as a result of looking at this situation in Corinth more closely, as reflected in Paul's comments here in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, I've found it necessary, you might say, to tweak my interpretation or the way I view some of Paul's comments in 1 Corinthians 7. And I just want to look at the first 9 verses here, and then we'll conclude the lesson. In verses 1 through 7, Paul is talking there about sexual... we're talking about intimacy, I think, closeness between a husband and wife, especially as it is expressed in the sexual relationship. Now, in the past, and this is perhaps one of the adjustments I've made to my thinking very recently about 1 Corinthians 7, I just thought Paul was talking in verses 1 through 7 about marriage. I think he's talking about, more specifically, about intimacy in marriage. Not just about sexual intimacy, although that's how it's most prominently expressed. But closeness, intimacy, between a husband and wife. Sometimes husbands and wives can become so intimate, and here I'm not talking necessarily about sexually, but they can become so intimate. They become wrapped up in one another's lives that they may not have time for other things. And they may not be prepared to meet the present distress that may come upon them, to use Paul's expression in verse 26. So, Paul here, in verses 1 through 7, is not simply addressing marriage, which he addresses, or which he reserves for later discussion, but he's specifically addressing sexual relations within marriage, or a little bit more broadly, intimacy between a husband and wife in marriage. Now, the Corinthians had probably asked him a question. Okay, they're facing this special set of circumstances, whatever it was, and they want to know about the propriety of intimacy between a husband and wife, and particularly about sexual relations within marriage. Should we be having sexual relations in marriage, they might have asked. So, when Paul says in verse 2, "But because of 4 immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband," the word "have" there probably means have in a sexual sense. Now, furthermore, since the sexual act itself is not necessarily long in duration, doesn't take up a lot of time, I don't mean to be crude here, but I feel need to express it in this way in order to understand what he is saying. Since the sexual act itself is not necessarily long in duration, but Paul here is concerned about time-consuming and intensive distractions. He's not just talking about the sexual act here. I wish there was some way I could express this without even seeming impolite or discourteous about it. But, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, well, let's read verse 5. Paul there says, "Stop depriving one another, except by agreement before time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer." I mean, how often can people engage, a married couple engage in a sexual relationship that they don't have time for prayer? So, what I'm suggesting there is that both prayer and the sexual act really refer to something larger than that. And I've already suggested that when Paul is talking about sexual intimacy, he's probably talking about intimacy between a husband and wife in general. The degree to which they're obsessed with one another, or caught up in one another's, in the relationship with one another. Okay? As a matter of fact, this is not entirely strange. Several years ago, we had a good friend and neighbor who would come to Bible study on Wednesday night. And I tried to get him to come on Sunday morning to meet with us here. Only very rarely did he come, and then, you know why he came on Sunday morning? His wife was out of town. And whenever I would talk to him about his need to come and meet with us on Sunday morning as opposed to Wednesday night, he would always say, "Well, I reserve my weekends, including Sundays, for my wife." And I think he might have even said, "I think the Lord would understand that." So it is true, sometimes people may get so wrapped up in their relationships with their husbands or their wives, they don't have time for the Lord. So I think the sexual act here is really, to use Jerry's term, a synecdoche, that is, a part put for the whole. For the whole level of intimacy, the whole relationship between a husband and wife. And also prayer here, I think. It's not just prayer itself, but probably refers to religious devotions and meditations and spiritual activities in general. I think maybe I should have advanced somewhere along here. Should have advanced PowerPoint. Here's where I am now. Prayer may be a synecdoche. That is, synecdoche is a figure of speech in which the part is put for the whole. That is, prayer stands for other forms of service to God. For instance, should a husband ever forego his relationship with his wife or in the sexual relationship as part of that general marital relationship? Should he forego that in order perhaps to go overseas for a while and teach or preach the gospel? Some do that. Yes. Yes. With her permission. Yes. With her consent, Paul says, he can do things like that. So this is not just talking about prayer. It's talking about spiritual devotions in general, I'm inclined to think. Just like later on when he talks about circumcision, he won't be just talking about circumcision in verses 8 and 9. He will be talking about the whole Jewish lifestyle. Also, the fact that Paul contemplates that they might forego sexual relations to give themselves to periods of prayer and tells them, what does he say? Come together again, verse 5. They were to come together again. Indicates that the Corinthians had asked him if husbands and wives might separate from one another for extended periods of time to devote themselves to spiritual pursuits. This present distress may have led them to think, do we need to separate from one another in order to deal with this present distress, to give ourselves to spiritual pursuits? And Paul says, yes, with your mate's consent, you can do that. Reminds me of Jephthah's daughter. It's not exactly a parallel, but it will give you some idea of what could be the Corinthians may be thinking about. In Judges, the 11th chapter, it's my thought here that probably Jephthah's daughter, and this may actually be an argument in favor of the idea that Jephthah didn't actually literally give his daughter as a burnt offering, but dedicated her to the Lord's service. She was going to be a perpetual virgin in the Lord's service. What does she do, though, before she enters the Lord's service in preparation, I suppose, for it? In verses 34 through 40, I don't know if we need to read all of this. That might be too time-consuming for our purposes. Let's drop down to verse 37 and start there. Now, she's telling her father that she's willing to accept what I believe is this perpetual virginity in service to the Lord. She says to her father, beginning in verse 37, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions." Then he said, "Go." So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and dwelt on the mountains because of her virginity. And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made, and she had no relations with a man. So that's the sort of situation I think that might be contemplated in 1 Corinthians 7, particularly verse 5. Just two more verses. Verses 8 and 9. We won't tarry long on those, I don't believe. Verses 8 and 9 of 1 Corinthians 7 say, "But I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn." Some people wonder, well, what does it mean here? It's better to marry than to burn. And some people might say, well, you know, that's Paul doesn't want you to get married, but if you go ahead and get married, okay, it's better to get married than to burn in hell. That's what the burning there is. No, I think that would be a mild way of saying it's better to get married than to go to hell. No, Paul is saying that it's better to marry than to burn with sexual desire. Spend your life trying to cope with these sexual urges that you have. You know, rather than trying to stay in a celibate state and deal with those sexual urges all the time and the temptations that might come with them, if you can't deal with it, you know, some people can deal with the sexual urges better than others can. He's saying, go ahead and get married. Despite what I've said, go ahead and get married. It's better to marry than to burn with unfulfilled, unsatisfied sexual desire. By the way, the word burn is used in Romans 1 in reference to sexual desire, although it's a different Greek word. It's a synonym there. It says in Romans chapter 1, verse 26, "And for this reason God gave them over to degrading passions." Notice passions there. "For their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the women and burned in their desire toward one another." So I believe it's the burning that he refers to here in 1 Corinthians 7 verse 9 is the burning of sexual, unfulfilled sexual desire. Celibacy in marriage, then, I think fits the immediate context of what Paul is talking about. Because notice he had been talking about self-control. And he mentions that again in verse 9. Back in verse 5, he had said, "Lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control." But also in verse 9 he says, "But if you do not have self-control." So he's dealing with the same sort of situation here. This is why verses 8 and 9 follow easily from what he said in the first 7 verses of the chapter. Because in both cases he's saying, you know, because of a lack of self-control in the sexual area, you may need to go ahead and get married, even though I think it would be better if you did not get married. So he really puts off or delays talking about the broader context of marriage and whether or not people should get married and why he prefers everyone should remain unmarried like him to a later time, verses 25 and following. Right now, since he's mentioned the sexual relationship and the matter of self-control in the sexual relationship, he wants to throw in some brief comments here in verses 8 and 9. Also, unmarried, since it's masculine gender in the Greek, may have reference to young bachelors, not to older men who may be unmarried for other reasons, but probably to young bachelors. And I'm thinking the widows he talks about here, who might opt, despite what he has said, to get married rather than burn with unfulfilled sexual desire, probably the young widows. Why would I say that? Because not to say that older people can't have that have sexual desire, but the younger people are the ones who struggle with that more, with libido. In 1 Timothy 5, verses 11 and 12, as a matter of fact, Paul says that very thing about the younger widows. In 1 Timothy 5, verses 11 and 12, he says, "But refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married. thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. So Paul even recognizes there that younger widows are going, might struggle with this, these sensual desires, and they might want to get married to fulfill them. So back in 1 Corinthians 7, when he says, you know, I'd rather have widows unmarried, but then again, if they're going to burn with sexual desire, then they can go ahead and get married. It's probably there especially talking about the younger widows. The older widows, he might address later on in the chapter, in verses 39 and 40. So if you want to make a distinction between what he says in verses 8 and 9 with what he says about marriage later on in the chapter, that might be the distinction to be made there. Next week we'll pick up with verse 10 then and proceed from there. Thank you very much for your patience here today. One of our purposes in meeting in situations like this is to encourage those who have not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ to do so. As a matter of fact, we try to encourage people generally, but particularly in the cases of those who have not been baptized into Christ, we want to encourage them to do so, that they might leave this place as saved people and might greet the next day of their lives in the arms of Jesus, so to speak, in a relationship with Him, a saved relationship. And therefore, we encourage you to do what the Scriptures say. This is not a matter of opinion here. I'm not stating my opinion. I'm not even stating Paul's opinion. This is the Lord's commandment. If you're not a child of God, you need, having heard the gospel, to believe in Jesus, repent of your sins, confess your faith in Christ, and then be baptized in a body of water for the forgiveness of your sins in order to become a child of God. If you've done that and have become a child of God, but since then have fallen away, maybe you've given yourself to the pleasures of the world. You've become more concerned with other relationships in life, so much so that your relationship with the Lord has fallen by the wayside, and you want to put things right with the Lord again. You might wish then, you might need to come before us and confess your sins and put things right with God and with your brethren in Christ. If this is your need, won't you come as together we stand and sing.